Welcome everybody to the second recording session for the International Collaboration Panel. So I wanted to start with a quick introduction round. Who are you, where are you, and what are your research interests? So I'll start with Oleg.
My name is Oleg Gang. I'm from Columbia University and Brookhaven National Laboratory. I'm interested in digitizing self-assembly through utilization of programmable ways to connect different components, both in static manner or in dynamic manner.
Let's go with Catherine next.
Hi, I'm Catherine Bugeaud. I'm at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. My lab specializes in the synthesis and self-assembly of nanostructures of DNA with cationic modifications for improved cell uptake.
Next is Willy.
Yeah, hello, my name is Willy Bay. I'm from the University of Surrey. And my lab focuses on utilizing bottom-up approaches to make protocells and developing some fundamental techniques in DNA strain displacement reactions.
Next, Peter.
Hey, my name is Peter Schulz. I'm an associate professor at Arizona State University. And we also have a small lab at Technical University of Munich. Our group mainly focuses on developing computational tools for DNA and RNA nanotechnology, and then using modeling-driven approaches to self-assemble multi-component systems out of DNA and RNA.
And finally, Hanadi.
Hi, my name is Hanadi Sleiman. I'm a professor in the chemistry department at McGill University in Canada. And I guess we have a lot of focuses in my research program, but the element that brings everything together is to make DNA nanotechnology, to open DNA nanotechnology to chemistry, to make it more chemically diverse, to create a new chemical space for DNA nanotechnology. And in terms of applications, we're very interested, just like Catherine, in drug delivery and nucleic acid delivery.
Great. It's lovely to have you all. The molecular programming field has done a lot of really cool work proving what can be done in molecular construction and molecular computation. And this hasn't been easy. Like, each of us has very specialized expertise in how we engineer these systems. But as these systems grow more complex and the potential for applications grow, we need to think about how the field approaches collaboration and building towards larger, more complex targets. So our first question is, what is your dream team of lab capabilities? It could be something that is currently untapped or something that you've already worked with in the past that you've worked very well and you'd like to see some more of?
I think that's a complex question, but when I look at like the trajectory in my lab, what we've tried to do is gain capabilities in synthesis characterization of DNA-based nanostructures and moving towards biological assessments. I think the challenge in the field is like a lot of the times when we publish, right, we want to have that synthesis, that characterization, that assembly fully nailed down, but also the application. And I think in terms of lab capabilities is having access to that application piece or that, I call it the more the explanatory piece, right? Like the modeling, for example, that explains why you see an emergent property. Or for us, it's a lot of drug delivery. We can show it in a model, but then what happens in higher systems? So I think when it comes down to collaboration is gaining that capacity, because it's typically a little bit challenging for students to switch gears from chemistry, from assembly, all the way to becoming full-fledged biologists or computer modeling people.
I think if you interpret molecular programming in the broader sense, it's not just DNA, even though it's probably the easiest and cheapest molecule to use, but you have a lot of things happening in protein design, RNA therapeutics as well, you know, artificial membranes, vesicles, etc. But it's very difficult to have synergy of these fields. Usually people are expert in one thing, but combining all the things together under one roof or having more crosstalk between the domains would be probably helpful. You know, I can plug protein motor into a design nanostructure and drill a hole in the membrane or something like that. You know, or use ATP-driven DNA arms powered by ATP that can rupture and divide vesicle in two, right? Some of these dream applications probably cannot come from a single lab alone. And they require some synergy, which is currently not really happening in the field.
Where do you think that synergy comes from in terms of expertise? Do you need someone who's an expert in DNA protein interaction, or do you need a DNA expert and a protein expert, and that interface can come from either side of the two of them working together?
I think you need somebody who works at the DNA protein interface, right? You need a DNA protein chemistry happening. but you also need somebody who knows how to design proteins and characterize them, and somebody who can design DNA. So those are more like three people than two separate groups, right?
Go ahead, Hanari.
I just wanted to add that you also need the synthetic element. So you need the design element and you need the synthetic element. And yes, I agree with Peter that it has to be a multi-person, multi-lab endeavor.
Willie?
Yeah. And I believe in these days, we're seeing more and more examples of applying generative AI in our field of DNA technology and beyond. And one key contribution that some of us can do is actually trying to establish a platform that can also contribute to the data set that generate AI needs.
Oleg?
So I kind of like, I'm come back to the questions that you asked before. The way how I see it is that there is a required kind of co-design from structural and functional point of view. We're becoming more sophisticated in the way how the structure can be formed and, you know, and perfected. However, when it comes to the application, it's require a different set of knowledge and different, and it's kind of like broadly speaking applicable, either we're talking biological application, we're talking optical application, it's require different expertise. And so in a way I see it's not, this co-design requires three elements. One of them, let's say, coming from programmable assembly, whatever it might mean, DNA-based, protein-based, peptides-based. Then the second aspect is a functional aspect, what is really needed to form. And the third element, it's also kind of what Hanari was mentioning, there is often some synthetic element. It can become in a flavor of maybe additional, some, I don't know, peptides. So it may be inorganic templating or, you know, nanoparticle synthesis, which kind of need to complement or add to desired function. So I see it's really three ways. Two is not sufficient from my experience. You talk to optical colleague and you know how to form something. At the same time, the performance is not there because it's kind of like synthetic component is not strong enough. In any case, so my comment is really to look at this little bit more holistically, kind of more from the what you want to achieve. Perfecting structure, it might be not sufficient anymore. And it's really what my concern, and I always kind of like trying to stress it, there are many fields which have risen and fallen because people were not able to bring this field to any applications. And, you know, and people from outside of the field look at this, people that you play your own game, but who cares at the end of the day if it's not transitioning into something. And I think that kind of like thinking holistically, there is a potentially way to make larger scale impact, but it's only we can transfer it to the application. I can go on and on, but I will stop it at this point. Yeah.
Let's go to Willie next.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what Oleg and Hanadi said. And I just wanted to add that, yes, it is absolutely crucial to actually coming up with the innovative solutions and having, or even having a connection with the stakeholders and potential investors, yeah, so that we can really create this circle of, you know, we do exciting things and that benefit people and that brings in money and that can also be helpful to the field in general.
And Hanari next.
I'm going to take it from Wooly as well. I can tell you what a big vision, a big dream of mine and many others are to see DNA nanotechnology applied in to solve biological problems, to solve drug delivery problems. I think, and I really do believe in the superiority of many of our DNA nanostructures for this wholeheartedly. However, the danger sometimes is when what Oleg said was a critical thing is that to have like multiple experts that come together. That's the best way. But when you don't have that, I can tell you from personal experience in our lab that many biological applications of DNA nanostructures are flawed. They're not correct. And that's because, not because people are, you know, trying to cheat. No, it's just because as you said, Oleg, you know, people that are making these DNA nanostructure don't necessarily know exactly what it takes to apply them to cells and then to apply them to animals. And, you know, when you don't have that, then you just start, you know, going into error. And as a result, there's actually a whole, honestly, a body of research in DNA nanotechnology that is not correct, if I want to be like, you know, I really... You know, we've seen it. We've actually experienced it in our lab. So that's the danger as well, is that we go towards application. We don't know what we're doing. And so we're actually, we just have all these publications that are not interesting or important.
So have any of you kind of sent students or postdocs to more application-focused labs to try to get your structures into applied systems? And how has that experience gone for you? Go ahead, Catherine.
Yes, I had this collaborative grant during COVID, which was meant to like overcome social distancing challenges and collaborations. And what we did for this one is we had like two students meet with one another online and kind of share perspectives with regards to their project and try to collaborate together. And we ended it with them going to each other's labs. So we had basically a collaboration with glycan chemists and trying to understand like the intricacies of their molecule, the stability. And it was a completely different language for my students, just used to like programming a synthesizer. I think that was actually very valuable in the sense that like their concerns and our concerns and like bridging that gap could only really be done because we had those thorough discussions. And then we were able to get the students to physically see how these things are done and appreciate like if you make a circle nucleic acid, it takes this much time. And then if you synthesize this compound, you have this scale to work with and adapt consequently. So I think, yeah, there's lots of value in having the students like go and meet one another where like the research is happening. So I think it's definitely something we should promote.
Yeah, this is something that came up as like a really beneficial thing in our meeting yesterday. We had a PhD student who just finished a Marie Curie project where the students were all able to meet together and really like interface with each other. I'd like to go to Peter next on this question.
Yeah, I tried two approaches. Still, the jury is out which one is better. I tried to recruit a student with like pure immunology background and teach him how to do DNA nanotechnology, or take my student and send him to immunology lab and learn how to do cell experiments. I'm still, none of the experiments is working so far, so I'm still not sure which of the approaches is the best, but it is definitely a big learning curve both ways, you know, and it's order of magnitude more difficult to get things working in cells, and that's yet another ball game to get them working in organoids, and yet another level to go into animals, right? But unless you have this experience and know what you are designing the structure for and what are the problems you're going to be facing, you're not going to make advances towards biological applications.
Go ahead, Hanari.
It's just an answer to Peter. I mean, after my multiple years of working in this field and trying so many different collaborations, I got to tell you, it takes a long time to find good ones. And so you're going to go through a lot of bad ones. And, you know, it's going to continue going like this until you find one or two that are good. And then you're going to go through another bunch of bad ones. But I think it's worth it. It's worth continuing. I really do. Even if it's discouraging, I feel.
Oleg?
I pretty much wanted to say what Hanari just said. I didn't want it to put it in any negative or positive, just matter of fact, you have to accept it. We have been trying to collaborate on this and this and so, and it's again, it takes just a lot of effort. If you want this to happen, you have to be patient. You cannot expect that idea which comes today will be realized in 1 year. That would be very unrealistic in a way, kind of like when you're starting. The difficulty is, you know, humans are humans, and then to find the right match between the science, human aspect, priority, because different people, and kind of it's applicable to all of us, we have different priorities in different times and so on. Whatever I would put higher priority today, it's not for tomorrow, and the same with other people. So finding this is difficult, but it is possible. What is important, kind of, again, from a roadmap point of view, it would be, you know, it's necessary to find potentially maybe some pool of people who might be open for ideas, because my experience often with people whom I, you know, let's say, for example, optical people, I will go and say, imagine anything is possible. What do you like me to do? You know, what we can create it would be. And most of the time, I don't get any answer back meaningful, because people just don't, you know, don't think this way. They know what they do every day. They know what techniques they're using. And so they bound to those techniques. So my point is that somehow kind of educating people, and if there is some larger scale way how it's possible to do, will open up their mind, and they will be kind of more potentially open to, you know, collaboration and so on. But again, the bottom line, it is big effort. Not everyone is ready to commit years to get, you know, results out. So that's, yeah.
Go ahead, Peter.
So it's also, if the recommendation from the meeting should be something for the funding panels, how to go forward, right? So one of the difficulty of sociology of these type of interdisciplinary collaborations is that, you know, money are tight. People have their own agenda. And if you come to experimental lab, like telling them, oh, you should spend the next 2 years trying to make this nanostructure work for your system, they are certainly not incentivized to try. If you have a funding which requires like two or three different disciplines to come together and they will have money from it, then it's going to be somewhat easier to push these projects forward rather than relying on somebody's goodwill to try structure just because you asked them to.
Go ahead, Hanari.
Just a question for you guys. You've been maybe more in touch with the ISNSC, with the Ned Seaman Fund. Are there any sort of seed funding for collaborations in DNA nanotechnology? Or is this something that we could maybe talk to the ISNSC and see if they can actually create that type of route for, especially for young professors or young researchers?
As far as I'm aware, they do not have these type of seed funding planned at the moment. At least they didn't announce anything. They are using the money to support travel for conferences, endowment of the prizes. But this is certainly something that, you know, could be brought up as a potential use of the endowment. Yeah.
So this is actually one of my questions that I had planned for this. So if the MPS or ISNCE were to come up with some sort of funding and support mechanism for either student exchanges, larger collaborative grants, or sabbaticals, what would you like that to look like?
I think it would be important to be kind of translational, so kind of encourage collaboration between let's say groups who are doing, let's say, for simplicity of, let's use it, molecular programming or whatever we can call it, and some, you know, I would, in a broader sense of application. So it, again, application doesn't mean necessarily gadget and so on, but translation to function. So that's, I think, would be very, very beneficial for two reasons. Not only demonstrating it can be useful, but also kind of like educating people who are, you know, in a very, very different field, that there are those means which are already kind of highly developed and potentially impactful.
Go ahead, Willy.
I agree with Oleg. And just one thing I'd like to add is for some other branches of physics, for example, like a particle physics and high energy physics, those, they have like a big facilities where they take applications from, you know, around the world about new ideas. And one good thing I like about those type of applications is they are like in a regular base. So when you are talking with someone, you have something you can already plan for, and you, that sets up the time scale, and that will really help bringing the conversation forward.
No, Hanari.
I just wanted to give an example of something I was in that was really nice. So there's a, it used to be called Horizon 2020. Now it's Horizon. It's in Europe. We have a project with a bunch of different countries. And we had so many students from different universities come to our lab and work with our graduate students. And that was really nice because, you know, the two expertise were there, the two students were there. I mean, honestly, a lot of the collaboration stuff happens, you know, oh, you're in a conference and you're just, you know, sitting down with somebody and say, oh, what if we did this together? But then there's no resources, right? And so, but then for with the Horizon 2020, it was like the two students were there, they were motivated, they were working together towards a goal that was defined. And so, yeah, I thought, and for the growth of the students, it was amazing too. So that's kind of a model.
Peter?
I think it's important to have multi-tiered funding, right? So at one end, you have these big translational applications, multi-team proposals like Oleg is suggesting, which are, of course, very important, but they usually cost lots of money. But it also is good to maybe look into current gaps in the funding schemes, right? So, for example, methods and tools development is something which is not traditionally funded through normal sources. There are some private foundations like Zuckerberg, which has like tool development or used to have tool development grant. But something which would be specific to molecular programming, you know, like developing protocol for interfacing DNA with proteins, for example, with one particle design and where the output would be protocol, tutorials, YouTube videos, lab school for students where they can come and get the skills, or developing new tools to design protein DNA hybrids, for example. Like these targeted methods would also be helpful, and they do not need to be super large and could also, you know, give preference to young PIs or like starting clubs as well.
Before I jump to Oleg, I just want to say that one of the things that came up in yesterday's meeting was kind of this idea where there are essentially three types of funding levels that are required for this sort of collaboration. So the first is just simply logistical funding that can get a student from point A to point B. And this can be on the order of like a couple thousand dollars, euros, pounds, what have you. And this is just enough money to get a student housing, pay their stipend maybe, fly them from point A to point B, but then the funding comes from an existing grant within one of the two labs. The second one is kind of what Peter just said, is to have these workshops where you bring a lot of people together and try to teach something, which require a little bit more resources, but they're kind of one-off events. And then the third is, of course, these much larger initiatives where you actually try to bring multiple labs together to do a collaborative project, which of course requires significant resources. And it's probably beyond the scope of just what ISNS can do, but it's something that we can, you know, apply for together. So that I'll throw it over to Oleg.
Yeah, so I just wanted to kind of like to comment something about what Wooly was mentioning, and this is in spirit of what everyone else was mentioning. Also, one point is regarding the kind of general facilities, which, let's say, acceptable in the physical community, like synchrotron collider and so on. There is nothing which can potentially stop establishing facilities which highly dedicated to, you know, let's say molecular programming. So in fact that we are doing something like this at Brookhaven National Laboratory. So for example, that's kind of like involved, for example, liquid robotics, which would be, you know, too expensive. And it's not just question of one cost, it's just all this maintenance and so on, in all additional characterization technique and so on. So what I kind of potentially envision, you don't need to raise a lot of money for your laboratory, and to be fully equipped, you can have kind of like sufficiently enough to scan samples what you need to do, but then the larger scales, you know, assembly characterization can be done in those facilities. And so that's a very different business model in terms of what you really need to run experiments, and to be, you basically need to pay for the student, but then there are a lot of kind of costs which is typically you consider can be done through these facilities. Also, those facilities can play a role not only kind of on the hardware and synthesis, but also accumulating different software developments and so on. And again, this is not just run by somebody who is this facility, but it's a kind of can be run by community with a presence in those facilities. The nice part about this, it's already funded. In a way, it's possible to find the way, for example, typical national laboratory in United States are funded through Department of Energy. So there is a certain funding. It's possible from, you know, I don't want to use the word manipulate, but it's possible to direct the funds more if there is a significant community demand. So that's kind of chicken and egg. But my point is it has multiple its goals. It requires somehow to get funding and redirecting, which already exists. It doesn't really require to bring for those. It's required building community. And, you know, as soon as the community builds, it becomes more clear what is needed, and that becomes necessary investment through this. It also essentially allows to connect people through, you know, all those and establish common tools and common approaches, which might be important for designing, for data collection, and it's kind of going back to what Willy was mentioning in the beginning, how we're unifying the data that we can collecting. So in any case, I think this is something which is very, I wanted to get specifically on the record because I just don't know when it's going to come up. But we had like a small workshop right after pandemic ended, and I will be happy to organize this workshop at Brookhaven and invite all of you and other people, and we can kind of like think from the community point of view where it's can be, how it can be developed, used, and so on.
Let's go to Willy next.
Yeah, actually Oleg has made an excellent point, and considering that as a community we actually have quite nice footprint over the world, you know, like in US, in Europe, and also in Asia, I would be very pleased to see, you know, if we as a community can come up with, let's say, those like a half a more connected structure to utilize the facilities that people are maintaining and promoting collaborations. But then for many funding applications, that also implies that the idea that we could pitch will have a better, let's say, feasibility and lower risk and more connectivity. So that's actually a fantastic suggestion. Yeah.
Go ahead, Nari.
Yeah, just to follow up on this, one of the other communities that I belong to, and I think Catherine does too, is the Oligonucleotide Therapeutics Society, the OTS. And they have a really nice model where, you know, young researchers, students, postdocs, professors, you know, the entire, they actually present and record sort of half an hour, basically, their research, their problems, whatever they want to say. And so everything is recorded, everything is available. And that actually really, really starts people talking to each other and creates a really nice community where, like right now, you know, if I can't make it to the FNano, you know, and many, many people around the world cannot make it, let's say, to the FNano or so the other conferences, we really don't know what each other are doing. And so sort of using a little bit more it's very simple to record a webinar, you know, and so using that for us to get to know each other and what we're doing.
Do these webinars, are they more focused on the research that people are doing, or are they kind mm-hmm. of more fundamental skills-based things, kind of like workshops?
Well, they are focused on the research, but there's no reason for them not to be like a workshop, not to be, for example, a primer. You know, Peter giving people like myself, for example, a primer on computational tools in DNA nanotechnology. I mean, I think any of these types of things would be amazing. Even, I mean, we have our own program from NSERC. But anyway, even, you know, recording how to do an experiment, how to, you know, so we have those on some of our website, you know, even sort of like a JOV type experiment, you know, but recorded and open and available. It will increase our reach, and it's not that difficult to set up.
Go ahead, Catherine.
Yes, I think I wanted to continue on Hanadi's points. It's a similar idea. It's also for the students, I think, to get a broader understanding of the field, because we can also not usually send them to multiple conferences a year, right? So it's this idea of like you're attempting something similar to what you're doing, but slightly new as well. There's expertise out there. Typically, the work is published, but getting to the nitty-gritty of the experimental or how to set up or like the stuff you should know that's not necessarily always completely spelled out. It would be nice to like have that forum or online community to reach out to.
Yeah, I mean, so we do have a little bit of that in the field. I kind of wonder if you guys think we have enough. So on the kind of web recorded webinar side, we have that UNano webinar series run by Catherine Dunn's consortium in the UK. So they do once a month, I believe, recorded webinars on almost always done by students or postdocs on assorted topics in nanotechnology. And then on top of that, we kind of have these more low touch communication platforms, which are a little bit diffuse and not everybody uses them, but they do exist in our field. So both MolPigs and MPS have Slack channels that some people use for publicizing their new papers, for asking questions of the community. There's also a message board on the Essence website that I think very few people use except for job advertisements.
Yeah, but
there there is a section there for, like, I have a question. And then the last thing I want to point out is that there's also Blue Sky. So I set up a molecular programming feed that picks up the last 3 days worth of posts from people in the molecular programming community. Again, very low uptake. We usually have like one or two posts every 3 days. So there's not a single place where like lots of people are. And part of it is just a communication problem that we don't have everybody, not everybody knows about each of these things. We need to find better ways to communicate that these exist. And the other thing is just like, we need to get people in fewer places. Like, why does both MolePigs and MPS have like overlapping Slacks that do essentially the same thing? And you know, a lot of people who are in one are in the other as well. So people do see both, but it's challenging. I'll go ahead and jump to Peter next.
Yeah, maybe one of the outputs could be that, you know, all the things that you just mentioned, they can be aggregated on a single website with links to the seminars and these resources. I know that some people, like Arun Richard on his homepage, he has like a links to all the labs around the world LinkedIn in nanotech. So this could be also perhaps maintained and supported by some mini donation from Essence, you know, to set up the website and record this. And there could be also like some mini grants for students, you know, like for $100 to record the protocol of an experiment or something. You know, my student records the YouTube video for some of the papers we publish as a tutorial. But, you know, if you want to have somebody record like Geoff style their experiment, there's a mini grant, $200, you know, from Essence that could also help, I think.
Go ahead, Catherine.
Yeah, it was a quick point based on what Peter's saying, but I find most of these initiatives are really successful when the students drive them. Like, I found that whenever I tell, hey, you should be doing this or I'll be there to monitor, it dies. So I wonder if there's also maybe associating that element to the funding stream, right? So it's having a leadership component from the students to maybe drive that community and make sure like they engage between themselves. And I think maybe that would make it a little bit more like I've seen my students, for example, use ResearchGate, right? When you're looking for some specific of how to run a Western blot, whether that blocking, like the community there answers and it's quite present. It's just like having a similar thing for DNA Nano could be really helpful.
Yep. And by the way, the UNano, I'm sorry, I'm not talking. I'm not.
Go for it.
The UNano, it doesn't record, right? Because it just, there's nothing under previous webinars, right?
Too
you just
bad.
Have to kind of like be there. Yeah, if people are comfortable.
One issue, of course, recording. Is that some people are not comfortable recording when they present unpublished data.
That's true. I mean, I'm just saying if people are comfortable, or in fact, if you tell them they're recording and they just share information that they're okay with, right? Because that just becomes a resource for like the next generation of graduate students.
Yeah, I mentioned this in yesterday's talk as well, but there's been this idea tossed around that we have kind of like early career ambassadors that kind of each lab has one who essentially one person whose job it is to know what the rest of the community is up to and really like share that out to their individual labs. It's something that like I'd really love to see. We've kind of tried to ask people if they're interested, but we've never really gotten much bite from individuals because nobody wants to be the person with extra responsibilities. But it's something that'd be great to have in the future. Go ahead, Hanadi.
It's also because many of us belong to multiple communities. So it's not easy, right? You know, you just how many students and how many communities do we, you know? So it's which is why I'm thinking, you know, maybe it's easier to have like some kind of a website that just has all of these things and then you can go to them. And as Catherine said, you know, you said about the Slack channel, but like all of it is integrated. Like, oh, I, you know, I'm having trouble with my origami assembly. What should I do, you know?
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that part. And I think maybe also just a written chat, something low-key. I do agree with the mention that students don't like recordings. I think that was something we tried when we were doing remote collaborations, film ourselves doing this synthetic thing. And then you realize you have to get the point of view. You have to get the sound. Our lab has massively loud ventilation, right? It becomes like super annoying. But then if you do it with webcam, or like technically, like we did it with GoPros and then phones. And then it's like, all of this is so annoying. And so, yeah, I wonder sometimes like the low key engagement could be easier. We found eventually what worked, it was kind of silly, is like they would both put their teams on like the meeting mode without the camera and talk to one another as they were doing their lab stuff. And then they started actually having a relationship and being able to ask each other questions without being too shy. But at the beginning, it was like yeah, two PIs, two students, all so formal with cameras and everyone's just self-conscious. So I wonder if like, yeah, putting maybe an effort towards like low-key, easy access, low barrier, and maybe for like the more general work, like maybe committing to, yeah, how to assemble an origami, how to design a nanostructure, might be a topic of a video or something that has demand and that might also encourage the students to see, oh, there's demand for this. Maybe you should do this, right? Maybe we could upvote what we do next or something like that.
Kind of jumping onto another collaboration topic. So we've talked a little bit about how we can collaborate on research projects, but also software is a big part of what we do. And I know Peter has a lot of experience with this. How have you guys worked on open source software projects? How has maintenance of those projects worked? And what would you like to see improved in our community? Like what software needs more maintenance? What would you like to see maybe combined into a single software that started as, you know, two different PhD projects that are now abandoned? What do we need more stewardship of, and how should we be doing that? Go ahead, Anari.
I'm going to start from a very personal place. Many of us are actually almost ignorant in computational tools. And so, but if the correct introduction and the correct, user-friendly approach, we can actually do a lot with it, and we can maybe even help push it forward. Sort of educating many of us on the tools. Like I'm just going to take OxDNA. That was transformational in MATLAB because it was just so simple to use, and so for us that was amazing. But stuff like this, you know, where we really understand what's happening and we don't think of it as a black box, is amazing.
Go ahead, Oleg.
So I think that some underlying problem when there is no really kind of maintenance for the software obligation. So it's up to the group. Sometimes they do have resources or they don't have resources. So now the difficulty, you're going into something, let's say you're investing time, you're using this, and then after some time, there is really, you realize this tool, it doesn't really advance. And it's not because no interest, because no, you know, maybe that particular group who developed this doesn't have resources. So I don't know how to solve it, but if it would be some way, again, for community somehow to be more engaged. And this can be done if the group is not continue developing the software, but software is popular somehow it could be some collaboration with the software, it's kind of maintenance passed to some other group. I don't know what the mechanism for this, but, you know, if you look even the simple question of how many DNA origami software are available, I don't know, but at least 10, maybe even more than that. In reality, it would be nice to have one or two, and then you know what would will be go-to software instead of testing, multiple and finding. So because the price for testing is very expensive, right? So you test not a software, you test if you can do something with this software. It becomes very quickly. And so, yeah, I don't know how to solve this problem, but it's normal stage when you kind of like, you have all this mutation, you have all this kind of biological organism, and then somehow evolution drives that one will survive. How this can be implemented to the software, I don't know. But this is definitely kind of like something which is limiting. I could argue that in the best case scenario, software should not be just engineering, because if it becomes everything I design like this, there is no soul, there is no kind of like spirit to discover something new. It should be always kind of developed by the people who wants to go and find what is behind the horizon. So, which is would be essentially the motivation for those computational group to develop. But again, I'm just basically saying this is a wish list. I don't know how to transfer into the reality.
Yeah, don't get me started on how many different DNA design softwares there are. Let's go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, so Ryan, it comes back to the funding issues that most funding mechanisms do not really give grants to develop software, right? It's usually you can develop it when you are studying a particular system, but as a side product, you have the software. So having a targeted funding for software development for a particular domain where you commit that everything will be put on GitHub under public source license would help the livability of these tools. Then, of course, interoperability between all the different tools is also important. And you know how difficult it is to sometimes intercorrect between different formats. And also part of the thing which I think is stopping more interaction between different aspects is that for many of the experiments, there are no good modeling tools, right? So, for example, for protein motors, there's really nothing that would work on the timescales required. There are not really cause-grain models really targeted for design protein nanodevices, right? And those are things which take almost one PhD to develop. And again, there could be some encouragement through targeted fundings. You might have heard that there was the Excellence Cluster in Munich just awarded, which reunites people from DNA, proteins, organoids, membrane physics. One of the ideas they have is to have like a database of nanostructures, broadly defined, including all possible materials. Or if you submit a paper from this cluster, you are also required to have somebody independently verify your protocol, and then it will get deposited to this database, right? So that's also not just design software, but also laboratory protocols and all the design files which describe the structure or device will need to have some commonly agreed format in which people deposit this. And also as a community requiring that whatever paper we review, make sure that all the structures they use, they don't just give you a text file with sequences, but they provide all the design files in whatever format the community likes, converted and deposited would also make a difference, right?
And Peter, maybe you can talk a little bit about kind of how OxDNA works. It's probably the largest of the open source software consortiums that molecular programming has. So basically, who runs it? How many labs are involved? And what would you like to see kind of better about its future?
I mean, OxDNA was basically started as a single student PhD project in my advisor's lab, right? And Tom Aldrich's thesis was the first version of the model. And then it was developed into high-performance computing tool, mostly by Lorenzo Rovigati and Flavio Romano, who continued to maintain the code base, to which then the grad students from the respective labs contribute. So I would say the active developers would be my group, Lorenzo, and John Doy and Arne Louis in Oxford, with some people joining like Oli in Glasgow, basically, is now also developing some parts of the model. So we are trying to establish a more formal governance structure, which like decides what features are implemented. But at this point, it's basically whatever each lab decides to implement becomes the code. And my lab was able to secure some NSF funding, which is just infrastructure development. So that allow us to design things like OxView, some easier interfaces for simulations like oxdna.org, etc. Ideally, what I would like to see in the future is that the software becomes so easy to develop that any lab that wants to have new functionality can basically nominate a student who will read through all the tutorials and learn how to implement a new function. And then they will have a process to commit this to the main code like you do with Linux-based systems or other open source software where you have open community of developers. But right now, it's still at the level that you really need to have a background in computational physics or chemistry to really be able to develop. And the way forward would be just to make the software easier and more even more documented so that the experimentalists who are using it could develop. And maybe tools like ChatGPT, which really eases generating of the code, might be a possible way forward. You know that we had some success like feeding Enter OxView into ChatGPT and asking it, you know, now that you have seen this code, try to expand it so that when I click, it colors the whole strand green from the nucleotide I clicked on, and these type of functionalities, it sort of can do it, but it makes mistakes one out of two times you use it, right? So we still need to understand the full code to see whether the code it has thrown at you is correct or not. But as these tools get better, I think at some point we'll be able to generate functional high-performance code from just text prompt, which people can contribute.
I just want to say that we're kind of getting to the end of our time here, and some people are having to drop. But we'll keep this going for a few more minutes for those who can stay on for a bit. So Hanadi, go ahead.
Oh, this is very fast. Before we go, I mean, some of our universities, at least in Canada, we have programs to send our students for sort of internships in other labs that are funded by the university or by other bodies. So, you know, as much as you can, you know, you want to tap into things in the US, but also there are other resources to tap into. I just want to add that, and you're happy to provide more detail if you're interested.
Yeah, that was actually one of the questions that I skipped over, is what resources are available to you? So yesterday we talked about how the Marie Curie program can really like fund student exchanges across Europe. And some of the groups in Japan mentioned that there are Japanese government funding sources that are explicitly for doing long-term interlab collaborations.
Oh.
So these mechanisms do exist across the world. And part of the trick for us is like just assembling these together so we know what's available.
Right.
And part of it is also, you know, what kind of advocacy can we do to say, okay, this kind of funding mechanism works. And then maybe our connections to our local funding bodies can help drive some of those collaboration mechanisms across countries.
Right. And you're, you know, matching, for example, to if you're, there's a program in Canada like this, maybe it can be easier to match than in the US.
Well, is it from one Canadian university to other Canadian university, or can you send people to Europe?
No. It's anywhere. It's an internship anywhere you want, including industry, any place. And many universities have those. Some universities don't in Canada, but many do.
Thank you, everybody, for joining. I hope the folks listening along have gained some valuable perspective, and I'm looking forward to see what comes out of the flight plan meeting next week. Our next meeting as a panel will be Tuesday morning for a live chat with the conference attendees. We hope to see some of you there. The usual MoPugs podcast will be back soon. We have our next recording session scheduled for the end of this month. And as always, if you want to get in touch, check out the MoPugs website or come say hi on Slack. See you next time.